All your base are belong to us. All your base belong to us.
Waka waka waka. Good afternoon, this is 90.7 FM, KALX. I'm Frank Ling, and this is Berkeley Grox.
That's right, it's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. I'm Charles Lee.
Coming up on today's show, carbon dating, bird doo-doo, and Bhopal.
In addition, Martin Pearl will join us to talk about creativity.
Also, we'll find out what a maser is.
So stay tuned for all this, plus the world-famous question of the week, coming right up here on Berkeley Grox.
Welcome back to Berkeley Grox. I'm Frank Ling.
And I feel like I'm Charles Lee today.
Wow. Are we like a comedy or a tragedy troupe here?
It's a little bit of both because, you know, in life, it's two sides of the same coin, right?
Yes. But this week, well, I guess the first story may be somewhat tragic, actually.
Uh-oh. What's the first story?
I probably was a little bit too young to remember this, but 20 years ago, they had a horrible accident in Bhopal, India, where a Union Carbide accident released a lot of cyanide into the environment.
Right. Well, I remember hearing about it. I don't remember seeing it.
But right now, after 20 years, they've started to address some of the issues of cleaning up and the local environment there. And still, there seems to be a lot of controversy. Activists are protesting how these sites are being cleaned up and the remaining pollutants that are still going into the environment.
Right, right. I mean, this has been going on for years, and especially, I guess, the health effects that have happened since then as well. So, I mean, what's the recent development?
The recent development is that the people who are trying to clean up the waste, none of them are wearing protective equipment. And, you know, while the testers are claimed that there's no more effluents going into the groundwater, some independent studies suggest that there's still toxicity there. So, you know, in contrast to all the benefits of technology, we're still seeing some ill effects that have not been addressed yet.
That's a shame. Hopefully they'll at least get some hazardous cleanup gear. Maybe Durex can lend them some, I don't know.
There's still international attention to this, and if people are concerned, they can always address it to Dow Chemical or Union Carbide.
Okay. All right, well, I guess I'll continue on the pollution theme since we've started on that already. It's a good way to start off the show whenever you talk about polluting the earth.
Yeah.
But this one actually has less to do with big multinational conglomerations, but rather seabirds.
Seabirds?
Yeah.
You mean they're putting doo-doo all over something?
Well, actually, you're right. In fact, the bird guano actually creates little hotspots of toxins.
I thought if they process it correctly, it'll become good fertilizer, right?
Well, I guess so. But, I mean, basically, the idea is that these birds will take up all these pollutants, concentrate it through biological concentration.
Right.
And then when they go fly somewhere and nest, they all sort of congregate in one spot, and then they do their business and, of course, release all the pollutants back into the system, but in a concentrated location.
So this would be actually a good way to clean the environment, right, by being able to concentrate all the vast into one particular place.
I guess so, but it's no good for, I guess, the place where it's been concentrated, right?
Ooh.
And it turns out that a group of researchers, Canadian researchers in the Arctic, have followed this. Jules Blaise of the University of Ottawa in Ontario and colleagues have basically looked at cliffs at Cape Vern on the northern Devon Islands in the Canadian Arctic. Mm-hmm. And what they've basically shown is that these birds are basically concentrating things like PCBs, HCBs, DDTs.
Jeez.
You know, all these sort of three-letter bad things.
CIA.
Yeah. And what it turns out, though, is that it gets concentrated in the local indigenous people who eat fish, for instance, that's caught from these lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they'll suffer adverse neurological effects and IQ deficits and things like that.
Jeez.
So it's not a good thing, and basically just shows that people need to be thinking about these things ecologically. Perhaps just by not polluting in the water in the first place, but anyway.
I wonder what animal has the dirtiest, most toxic natural waste.
I think that would be man.
Man?
I don't know, actually.
Mine floats, you know.
Well, that's a sign of good health, I think, according to various Chinese wisdom, I think. Floating stool, keep that in mind. If you don't learn one thing on this show, I haven't learned anything from this show, really. But
I think I've forgotten things from this show.
I sometimes forget I even do the show. And which is a good thing, because that might help. But anyway, so this is published in the recent edition of Science.
Okay, so Charles, so something more cheerful. Are you smart enough to be happy?
I'm smart enough not to be anything, really. I'm sort of like the guy who goes around and just like looks at people and wonders who they are.
So it turns out in a recent study from Scotland that there's actually no correlation between intelligence and happiness.
Okay.
So in a study with 416 people who are aged 80, it turns out that there's no correlation between their cognitive ability and their satisfaction in life.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
That's not good.
Right. And this is sort of surprising because I guess the consensus that, you know, intelligence is valued in Western society, and intelligent people tend to, you know, be wealthier, more financially satisfied, and have higher status.
Okay.
But it turns out that it's not the case, in fact.
Oh, geez.
The thing that sort of explains this is that, you know, intelligent people are also probably more concerned about achievement and more aware of, like, alternative lifestyles, which may lead to their dissatisfaction. And also, you know, they tend to be more independent, so they are not part of any strong social networks.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting to know, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, good to know.
Yeah. I'll give up my brain for some friends.
If I had either one of those, I guess I'd be happy, but... You're my friend, right?
Yes.
Okay, and you're my brains as well, I guess. So it works out perfectly. Very cool. So if you want to read more about this.
This is a very nice article in a recent edition of New Scientist.
All right, Frank, so how old are you?
How old? I think chronologically about 29.
Okay, well, you know, happy birthday anyway.
Oh, thanks, but I don't know how much longer I'm going to live, though.
Well, it turns out, though, that not all your cells in your body are going to be 29 years old.
So there's a standard deviation or something, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, some cells turn over more rapidly than others because of, you know, their wear and tear.
Uh-huh.
And now researchers have been able to date the cells using carbon dating.
Carbon dating?
Right.
So do I still have any stem cells from when I was born?
Well, you might, actually, or at least the ones in your brain apparently are very long-lived.
Really?
Yeah. So it turns out because the brain has to be very stable and very structured, uh-huh. The cells don't divide. They're sort of what's called terminally differentiated.
Uh-huh.
And basically the DNA that's in there sort of sets since whenever, right?
Oh, okay.
And so basically through the radioactive carbon dating method, where they can measure the amount of radioactive carbon in the system,
uh-huh.
They've shown that basically... these cells are much older than, say, the liver cells, where there's high turnover.
So I wonder if there's a correlation between the age of the brain cell and happiness.
Yeah, I wonder, actually. Certainly, I guess when you're younger, you're certainly a lot happier.
Uh-huh.
You don't know anything, too.
Ignorance is bliss.
That's what they say. So very fascinating work, and it actually shows a novel method for carbon-14 dating, for actually measuring, in this case, DNA, the age of the DNA. So very fascinating work. It was published in a recent edition of Cell.
And that's all for this week's look at current developments in the world of science and technology. This is Berkeley Groxel listening to here on 90.7 FM. In a few moments, Martin Pearl joins us to talk about creativity in science, and Terry Hazen will talk about microwave detection technology. So stay tuned. Do you love the Welcome back to Perfect Rocks. Well, the basis for many scientific discoveries and artistic creations is creativity. At an event here in Fort Mason at the Magic Theater, we have Quantum Leaps, an investigation of how creativity has been essential for a lot of these scientific discoveries. Well, joining us today is a very special guest, Professor Martin Pearl from Stanford University. Professor Pearl is a Nobel laureate in physics, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his work and some of the creative thought process that went behind it. Professor Pearl, thanks for joining us today on Berkeley Rocks.
Okay, let me say about creativity. My method has always been to look at things and work on things that other people aren't working on. If other people are doing it, let them do it. I can read what they did, or they can tell me about it. Why do it? It's harder. Okay, so the idea is to get ideas and directions, whether it's science or art, that are your own. Now, there are a couple of rules I have for doing this. The first rule is most ideas that you get at the beginning are not going to be good. They're going to be wrong, they won't work, or they have a lot of problems with them. You have to stick with the ideas, in spite of people saying, oh, that's no good, that's been done, or that doesn't work. You have to try to get your own ideas and stick with them. Now, that has a lot to do with the people you work with and talk to. Because some people are very smart, maybe smarter than you are, or faster, and they will say, oh, that's no good, you don't want to do that, don't do that, that's no good. Stay away from those people. The people you want to work with or be friends with are those who are supportive, and you tell them your ideas, what you're going to do, and they say, well, that's interesting, but they don't say much. They let you develop it yourself. So that's the secret is getting supportive people to work with. And now, eventually, they may say to you, this is not such a good idea because of, well, in my case, physics, it violates Newton's laws. But that should be very gentle. Now, when you're working on a new idea in art or science, it should obsess you. When you wake up in the middle of the night, you should not be thinking of your girlfriend or boyfriend or wife or husband. You should be thinking about the thing you're doing. That should wake you up. So it's got to really pervade you. And that's how you get these things done. But all obsession, you have to know how to control. Some people try to work out an idea in science or in art, and after years it doesn't work or it's not going well. And they just keep obsessed with it. That's a mistake. You've got to know when to quit. You've got to say, okay, this is not working. I don't know how to do it. But there will be new people, younger people, smarter people, better trained people. They will go ahead. So you just have to drop it. And that's one of the hardest things to do in creative work. When to drop an idea that you've worked on for some number of years, or a project, or an experiment, or something you're building. So that's how I feel about creativity. It's a tricky business. Yeah.
Wonderful. So it's something you have to love then.
Yes, it's something, it has to be something you love. You love to work on, yeah.
And could you tell us a little bit, briefly, the science behind the Nobel Prize that you received in 1995?
Sure. 100 years ago, the electron was found, and that's this very small particle, which is the basis of all electronics.
By J.J. Thomson, right?
Right. And it turns out that there's a very heavy version of the electron, which is what I discovered, which is called the tau, which is about 3,000 times heavier. And I got that idea to look for it in about the 1960s and 70s, and there was no theory behind it. I just sort of had this idea, and we built this kind of accelerator that was going to do many things, and one of the things it did, I looked for this particle, and in fact, we found it. So this is like an electron. It's 3,000 times heavier, and it's not stable. So as far as we know, you can't do electronics with it. It breaks up in about a millionth of a sec, but it's become one of the cornerstones of modern particle physics.
And Science Magazine recently came out with a list of the 25 most unsolved problems.
Yeah.
What are some of the more, physics-related problems that you would encourage people to work on these days?
Well, I think we're just at the beginning of physics, because once in a while a physics idea comes just straight out of thought. That's what Einstein did with general relativity. Most of the time you can't do that. Most of the time you need data or experiments that conflict each other. So what I urge people to work on are things which will go deeper into, and I think we're just at the beginning because we're always limited by the accelerators we have and the detectors we have. And so there are many questions that I have. One, what is actually the nature of mass? We know how to measure it, but what is it? And another question is quantum mechanics, is there any quantum mechanics related to gravity? All the experiments we do on gravity are actually not quantum mechanical. They're classical experiments. Newton would understand them. How do you do a quantum mechanical experiment on gravity? I don't know. Such a weak force when you get down to the very little. So, and another thing which puzzles me immensely, and I don't know how to do a good experiment on, is the question of time and whether you can reverse time for short periods and how you would find that out. So actually travel backwards in time for short periods. Somehow the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says you ought to be able to do that. But I don't know how to figure out an experiment to demonstrate that. So those are the sort of things I urge people to work on.
Great. I guess we're running out of time. Are there any last words you'd like to add about yourself or to future scientists?
Only that science is better and more powerful than ever. It's just amazing. And sometimes a field will slow up, but then there'll be new inventions using new technologies, and then such a laser came along, and then fields will speed up again. So you, in some sense, you have to be patient, and you have to try to pick those fields where you have the most power of experimenting.
Great. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Frank.
We were just talking to Professor Martin Pearl from Stanford University. He's a researcher at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and in 1995, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of the tau particle. Coming up, Terry Hazen joins us to talk about detecting dangerous pathogens in the water. This is Berkeley Grox you're listening to here on 90.7 FM. Well, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita may have passed, and the immediate threat of a powerful storm has subsided for now. Nevertheless, the warm and wet conditions that surround the Gulf Coast still poses a serious hazard. Microbes such as bacteria, viruses, and fungi can produce deadly toxins in the environment. Critical to a recovery effort is understanding what kind of pathogens are there.
Well, a team here at LBL is doing exactly that. They're developing a device for on-site evaluation.
Well, joining us right now to talk about microbe detection is
Senior Staff Scientist Dr. Terry Hazen, who's also the head of the ecology department there. Dr. Hazen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, first of all, could you describe what exactly is the problem that hurricane-stricken areas face after the storm itself?
So, one of the things that will happen is that you have multiple sources of contaminants, both chemical and microbiological, from sewage sources, from decaying bodies of animals and God forbid even people. And then also you have a lot of other sources. And of course, because of all the organics in the water and nutrients that have been released and trees, brush, just everything you can imagine, it's this toxic soup, and the microbes actually not only can survive in that, but in many cases actually grow and multiply. The problem is we don't necessarily know what to expect because it's not just one source.
I see. And what are some of the analytical tools that scientists use to evaluate?
So one of the things that actually has been used for nearly 100 years now is using culture techniques, looking for coliform bacteria or bacteria that live in the gut that give a specific reaction on media that are fairly easy to identify on the media. Mm-hmm. Now, but all that tells you is that there's a possibility that there was recent human fecal contamination. The problem is we've shown that in these warm waters, especially with high organic levels, that these types of bacteria will grow and multiply, so they don't necessarily indicate recent human fecal contamination and the possibility of disease. The other techniques that are starting to be used are DNA extraction techniques for specific pathogens and a variety of probes that can be used to specifically detect a pathogen. In this case, though, you don't necessarily know what you're looking for and what might be there, and it would be cost and time prohibitive to test for everything.
Mm-hmm.
What we've developed is, and in particular, Dr. Gary Anderson in my group has developed a phylochip that basically has almost all the known bacteria and archaea on it. And so those two groups of bacteria, and it basically looks at a specific section of their DNA that's highly conserved and can identify them to the species level. So by putting the DNA onto the chip, we see virtually the possibility of 9,900 different species that might be present.
I see. So if the microbe is present in the water, supposedly their DNA will conjugate with the strand that's on your chip. Is that
that's
correct?
Right. That's right.
I see.
And it lights up, and it's a little laser scanning device. It's a DNA microchip technology, and we're using a local company, actually, that makes these for us to our specifications, Affymetrics. And it's the size of a quarter, but it has 550,000 spots on it for testing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of redundancy on the chip where we can look at matches and mismatches and make sure that we're getting the best possible answer for what species are present in that original sample.
I see. So besides these E. coli-type bacteria, do you also see things like anthrax?
The chip has anthrax on it. It virtually has all the known pathogens on it. So Shigella, Salmonella, Yersinia, Yersinia pestis, which causes plague. So it would have everything on there. And that could be pretty important in these hurricane-stricken areas to see what, in fact, is showing up. And also for the pathogen screens that they're doing, to see what other organisms are also showing up in what abundance they might be in that might cause a false reaction for the specific pathogen tests that they're doing. So this basically screens everybody that's there and might give us an idea if there's some closely related bacillus species, for example, that might give a false anthrax reaction or question your response from a particular assay as to whether it was really the pathogen that was there or not.
In terms of like your greatest concerns, what kind of germs are you most worried about, or you know, can they actually become airborne?
Yeah, and of course, as they dry it out, the the water will sorb into the soil, and a lot of the microbes can become sorbed into the soil and actually remain active there for a very long period of time. They, of course, will be concentrated down as the water evaporates and is pumped out too. And so you could have some concentration effect occurring there. As it even gets dustier and dirtier, and that you get aerosols, and those bacteria could be going into the air and causing infections this way. For example, Legionnaire's disease bacteria.
I see.
A variety of things like that. There's just a very large number of possibilities, and this is one tool that we could use to screen both in the air, soil, and water, because basically we can take a sample without culturing it, extract the DNA wherever it's from, and then tell what organisms are there, what bacteria are there.
Great. So on a related topic, the bird flu has been getting a lot of attention, and there's been some concerns that there could be a worldwide outbreak in the next year or a couple of years. Are there also techniques for detecting the viruses that cause bird flu?
It's possible that these types of DNA chips can be developed for that. In fact, because the chip makers like Affymetrix are now making chips even that have more than a million test spots on them, that in fact we could put not only maybe all the bacteria on there, but all the fungi, all the viruses, virtually any microorganism that might be out there could be put even on one chip, potentially. Now, the extraction techniques and things like that would have to be worked out to do that, and this is going to take us a while, but there is the potential to do that.
And how fast can we get results back from this technique? Can we also put it under a UV lamp to see our targets light up?
No, it's actually a laser,
okay.
And it fluoresces. The laser causes it to fluoresce, and a detection system that Affymetrix has developed.
I see.
And then it's scanned, and we've developed a software that then interrogates each pixel of the fluorescence on that chip. Because you can imagine 550,000 spots on an area that's about the size of a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So the software goes through and analyzes that and then assigns a certainty to whether it's a particular species is present or not.
Great. Dr. Hazen, thanks for joining us today.
Yep, you're welcome.
And we were just talking to Dr. Terry Hazen from Lawrence Berkeley Labs. He's a senior staff scientist and the director of the ecology department. In a few moments, we'll find out what a maser is, so stay tuned.
The answer to last week's question of the week with Esteban the Spaniard. My friend, what is a maser? It's so amazing. It's so penetrating. Oh, just like a Spaniard. It's a microwave amplifier through the stimulated emission of radiation. Kind of like a laser, but with masers. Microwaves. Ooh la la.
And now Forrest Gump with this week's question of the week. Down here in the South, my sweatshirts are all red. Beautiful red. But how did it become so red? I always wondered. Any special chemicals out there? Well, if you know or think you know, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com. You won't win anything, but you might just be on my team. And that's all for this week's edition of Berkeley Grox.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us here at Berkeley Grox, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com. For Berkeley Grox, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.grox.net. Have a great afternoon and stay tuned for more music.